Welcome to The Warcast, your geopolitical briefing that tells you what you need to know, when you need to know it. The Warcast is for War on the Rocks members only. Spread the word and tell your friends and colleagues to sign up at warontherocks.com/subscribe. I'm talking in this episode with Doug Olivant, a senior fellow at the Future of War program at New America. And Doug is one of our best experts on Iraq, and he's here to help us understand the retaking of Mosul by the Iraqi government, the victory in the Battle of Mosul. You know, we've already heard that the government's obviously declared victory. A lot of people have suffered and sacrificed to get to this victory. We also know that there's still some pockets of the Islamic State left in the city in different parts of Iraq, and that they'll go underground. What sort of strikes you most about what the biggest task is, the biggest next task is?
Well, right, there are all kinds of tasks still to come. You're right, the victory in Mosul has to be, you know, fully cemented down. There will be little pockets here and there. There are certainly, you know, probably some former executives or civil servants of the Islamic State who are there. They'll have to be dealt with. But I think we need to take a moment and just acknowledge how big a deal this is. The Iraqi government, largely the Iraqi army and counterterrorism services, the army that was so embarrassed by the fall of Mosul almost 3 years ago, has retaken the city. And this is a huge turnaround for the Iraqi government, and the Islamic State is now losing the control of territory that allows it to conduct its most heinous tasks in its genocidal mode. So this is a big deal. So yes, you need to cement the victory in Mosul, get rid of the remnants that are left, and then move on to the other cities still occupied in Iraq, most notably Tal Afar and Hoveja.
It's pretty striking that in this day and age, a group that began as a terrorist organization could take and hold a major Middle Eastern city for 3 years.
Well, I've written about this for you, Ryan. There are these groups that I call these hybrid warriors, groups like the Islamic State, like Hezbollah, that have taken on this paramilitary role and that can hold terrain in a manner that is very similar to that of a state force.
What are the major lessons that the Iraqi forces are taking away from this? Can we first talk a bit about which part of the Iraqi security forces bore the brunt of the fighting here?
Well, the brunt of the fighting was borne by the counterterrorism service, their elite special operations force that has been trained by the United States for some time. It was always a multi-sectarian force. They've taken quite severe casualties in this fighting. But there were also two divisions of the Iraqi army in the city, actually pieces of three divisions, the federal police from the Ministry of Interior, and their specialized kind of SWAT unit was also involved. This was a broad coalition from the Iraqi government with the Kurdish Peshmerga and the Hashid, the PMUs, both kept outside the city in a security role.
I'd like to ask about each of those different services in turn. You mentioned the high casualties the counterterrorism service took. I saw one estimate from DOD is up around 40% casualties.
That's the one estimate. Now, of course, you know, casualties can be wounded, so some of those may be able to come back or at least serve as trainers as they're at their base as they work to regenerate. But yeah, they paid a high price to retake Mosul, no doubt.
It's something I've noticed in not just Iraq, but we've seen this in Afghanistan, where you've also worked, served, and I think we've seen this in the Philippines as well, where a lot of these security forces that are either built with the aid of American, advised, train, and assist missions, or at least helped in some way with security force assistance, we tend to see that the most competent fighting force are these special operations services. You mentioned the counterterrorism services. And their equivalent in Afghanistan, it's the same. So they end up being used as sort of shock troops and light infantry in a way that we don't use our own special operations forces. And the sort of competence, main fighting competencies are sort of clustered in these special operations units. Do you think this is a problem for these countries overall as they try to develop durable, functioning security services?
I'm not sure that's a fair critique. I mean, when you have an existential problem, you do tend to throw your best force at it. You know, we use the 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions as line infantry at key points during the Second World War because we needed those extremely well-disciplined formations. So I think the Iraqis here did something very similar. Yes, this is designed as a counterterrorism force, but it turns out to be your best light infantry force, and therefore you use it on this key objective.
When Mosul, shortly after Mosul fell, we published an article in War on the Rocks that you probably remember by some people that we both know that used to work at Keras, a company that our friend Aaron Simpson used to run, talking about why and how the 2nd Division lost Mosul. One of the critiques that's been levied against the Iraqi army in that time was that it sort of become a corrupt checkpoint force. Do you think that the Iraqi security forces have sort of learned this lesson, the mainline forces, the army units, moving forward?
Well, let's take those and let's split that as a checkpoint force and as a corrupt force. The Iraqi army absolutely was a checkpoint force, and it was a checkpoint force because that's what the United States Army trained them to be. In retrospect, there were some real shortfalls in the way that the United States trained the Iraqi army in the last days before we left in 2011. With regard to the corruption, that was certainly true. I think that's something that has certainly gone away. You know, no commander exaggerates the number of soldiers he has when he's in a hard fight because he doesn't want to tell someone he has 500 soldiers when he has 200 and be assigned a 500-soldier mission. So certainly I think the checkpoint force has been fixed. I mean, let's be candid. The Iraqi army, and particularly the CTS, now has to be considered one of, if not the most competent fighting forces in the Middle East, in the region. You know, there's no other force that has been able to engage in high-intensity urban combat, you know, graduate-level combat, for so long and still be able to maintain itself. So,
I mean, aside from Syria, of course, but yeah, I think they're both up there.
You know, I don't think, yeah, the Syrian army, but certainly not the same type of, you know, offensive. We have people who are, I won't counter that. There's certainly urban combat going on in Syria as well. But not in the same type of organized fashion, I would maintain. But anyway, will the corruption issues be fixed? Look, it's Iraq. It has a corruption problem. The entire region has a corruption problem. Is the corruption probably going to come back? Yes, probably not to the same extent. And I think the commanders that have fought the Mosul fight will probably be a little less tolerant of such things in the future.
Could we talk a bit about these other forces that played a role, the Hashid, the popular mobilization units, and the Kurdish Peshmerga? I know there were some concerns as far as the former going into Mosul, a predominantly Sunni city, and causing trouble, given that most of these PMU units are, the vast majority of them are Shia, and some of them quite sectarian Shia. And you said they were kept outside of the city largely in this offensive?
Right. Both forces were. And I think you can almost deal with them simultaneously. Both the Hashid as a purely Shia force and the Peshmerga as a purely Kurdish force were seen as suspect by the people of Mosul. The Shia, because they thought they might be excessively judgmental of the Sunni citizens, and the Peshmerga, frankly, because it was not clear they have a reputation for not leaving once they take a piece of terrain and thought that they might try to annex part of Mosul to the KRG. So the government of Iraq, I suspect with our help, was successful in keeping both of those groups outside the city and only forces directly responsive to the government of Iraq. The CTS, that reports directly to the Prime Minister's office, the Ministry of Interior and Ministry of Defense troops were inside the city.
So is the Iraqi government does not intend to allow the Hashid forces to play any occupying role in Mosul?
I don't believe so. Now, whether the Hashid forces will be involved in the fight to take over Tal Afar in the future, they're certainly lobbying to be given that role. I'm not sure the Iraqi government is excited about that. I know we're not excited about that. So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds.
How important has the personality and leadership of Prime Minister Abadi been to making all this happen, especially as a contrast to his predecessor?
He has certainly done almost all the right things and has set the right tone. as he's moved forward. And you can see this in how the formerly ISIS-occupied cities seem to be recovering. The University of Tikrit is back up and wants to host conferences and is graduating students after being occupied by the Islamic State and being near the scene of some of the most horrendous atrocities. So he has certainly set the right tone, seems to be reaching out to all the citizens of Iraq, seems to be hitting the sweet spot.
Could you talk to us a bit about the destruction of the mosque in Mosul from where Baghdadi, who now might be dead, although that's not yet confirmed, announced his caliphate?
Yeah, I mean, the Islamic State destroyed this historic, kind of iconic mosque for the city of Mosul. You know, it had the same relevance or the same iconic status for the city of Mosul that, say, you know, the Arch does in St. Louis or the Washington Monument does in D.C. or the Eiffel Tower in Paris. And so the Islamic State destroyed it as the Iraqi forces were closing and about to recapture it rather than have it be, recaptured by the Iraqi forces and give a propaganda victory. And that's it's a very sad event for the people of Mosul.
Last question. I was wondering if you could give us a preview of sort of the next big issues in Iraqi politics, upcoming elections, political coalitions, and so sort of the big issues that will define who what the next government is that runs Iraq.
Well, it's unclear how this will all come together. We are starting to see some cross-sectarian coalitions. Muqtada al-Sadr and the former prime minister Ayad Alawi have announced that they're forming a cross-sectarian coalition. It'll be interesting to see
if someone would have told you 10 years ago that would have happened.
It would have been unthinkable 10 years ago. So now, again, those may not be my preferred players to be the ones initially setting up the cross-sectarian coalition, but just the existence of a cross-sectarian coalition is extremely encouraging. And I think this is something we need to watch very closely in Mosul. The largely Sunni citizens of Mosul have welcomed the majority Shia Iraqi security forces into their city with wide open arms. They're being welcomed as liberators. You can go watch the videos on YouTube. There are some very, very encouraging signs that the liberation of Mosul and these other cities may be a game-changing event for how the Iraqi citizens see each other. Or at least we'll get a little honeymoon in which that is the case that the Iraqi government can either take advantage of or not.
So that, I said that was going to be my last question. I lied. I have one more. I'd like you to speak to what happened in the Battle of Mosul. What does this tell us about the role of two outside powers in Iraqi affairs? The United States first and Iran second.
I think it goes to show that at the end of the day, this government at least cares more about the United States than it does about the Iranians. You know, the Iranians probably would have loved to have had the Hashid involved in the retaking of Mosul. That simply didn't happen. I think the Iraqi government realizes that the United States is a far more capable, far more important partner than are the Iranians. The United States can simply bring things to the table, not only in terms of military support, but in terms of diplomatic support. I'm sure we had something to do with the recent rapprochement between the Iraqis and the Saudis. The United States played a key role in arranging this bridge financing that the World Bank and IMF put together to help Iraq get through this period where it's having to spend so much of its GDP on the fight. The United States is simply a more capable ally. And that's a simple statement of fact. I think the Iraqis are realizing that.
Great. Thanks so much, Doug.
My pleasure.